scripture, but it's a long one, so maybe we'll look at parts of it in a different way. It's in Matthew chapter 15. Just a very simple thing I'd just like to share tonight, that's all. Matthew chapter 15. And if we just put this story in its context, the story I want to refer to is this that begins in verse 21. This woman who in Mark's Gospel is called a woman of Syrophoenicia, and here she's called a woman of Canaan. I'll read from verse 21, and then we'll go backwards and then forwards as well. Then, not at the same time. Then Jesus went from there and departed into the borders of Tyre and Sidon. This was the one time in his earthly ministry when he moved out of the land that we would call the Holy Land or the land of Israel. And he moved right up into the north to some of these towns, first of all, that were on the coast, Tyre and Sidon. And then after this, he came down, my geography is not very good, but he came down on the right-hand side, the eastern side of the Sea of Galilee, through some cities that were called Decapolis, which really, they were 10 Greek cities, and an area which was very Gentile. Do you remember that they referred to Galilee of the Gentiles? Do you remember that phrase? Galilee of the Gentiles. The area around Galilee had lots and lots of Gentiles. It was part of the northern kingdom that had been taken into captivity, what, kind of 700 years before all this. And then foreigners had been imported into the land, and there were lots and lots of Gentiles in this particular area. And this is a time in the Lord's ministry when, although he has come primarily for the lost sheep of the tribe of Israel. If I'm speaking very slow to you, it's because I've just spent a whole week with the church life student. So I can't think in proper sentences anymore. I shall stop dreaming in broken English. this was the time when he spent part of the time in an area which was predominantly Gentile. And here's one of the references to it. And it's a poignant thing, because he had gone from the area where people ought to have responded to the word. God had specially worked with the Jewish nation for hundreds of years, preparing them, sending them prophets, chastising them, disciplining them in all kinds of different ways to get them ready, so that when the Messiah came, they would be able to recognize him, they would be able to receive him, and they would become a missionary force to be a light to lighten the Gentiles. That's what God intended to happen. And the tragedy was, and it summed up in John's Gospel in just a few words, he came to his own, and his own received him not. All that God had planned for hundreds of years really was squandered. And these people said no to him. And it's poignant, ironic, whatever the word is, because he then goes north for a while, up onto these kind of the northeast coast of Tyre and Sidon. And verse 21 says, then Jesus went thence and departed into the coasts of Tyre and Sidon. And behold, a woman of Canaan came out of the same coasts or the same borders. This is why I say this is ironic or poignant. The people of Canaan, how long ago? 1,500 years before this, had been expelled from the Promised Land. Their lives were so wicked, so dissolute, there were such vile practices amongst them, that God actually said on one occasion, the land is vomiting them out. That's what God said. He said, it isn't just that the Israelites are visiting my punishment upon their wickedness. The land itself is sick of them, can't stand them anymore, is vomiting them out. And the Canaanites were either destroyed or driven out of the land. And now, 1,500 years later, you've got one of these Canaanites, or a descendant of one of these Canaanites, that has this encounter with the Lord Jesus. And it's ironic, because in the land of Canaan are the Israelites, who are now saying no to what Jesus Christ is saying. And outside of the land of Canaan, you've got a Canaanite who is now saying yes to Jesus. Really is amazing. There's a tremendous contrast in this particular part of his ministry. And the reason I want to share this, and what happens with this woman, and what happens afterwards, is, I suppose, more than anything else, because I just feel I want to talk about the character of God. I know you know what he's like, but I just want to say again what he's like. Sometimes he allows things, he causes things that we would never have expected. They don't fit into the pattern of our expectation of what he's like or what he ought to do. Sometimes they look almost harsh and unfeeling. Like this one, let me read it, I'm not getting very far with it, but verse 22. And behold, a woman of Canaan came out of the coast and cried to him, saying, Have mercy upon me, O Lord, thou son of David. My daughter is grievously vexed with the demon. But he answered her not a word. And his disciples came and besought him, saying, Send her away, for she cries after us. But he answered and said, I am not sent, but to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Then she came and worshipped him, saying, Lord, help me. And he answered and said, It's not meet to take the children's bread and to cast it to the dogs. And she said, True, Lord, yet the dogs eat of the crumbs which fall from their master's table. Then Jesus answered and said unto her, O woman, great is thy faith. Be it unto thee even as thou wilt. And her daughter was made whole from that very hour. It's an amazing story. It's in Mark's Gospel as well. I think it's Mark chapter 7 or something like that. And in Mark chapter 7, it tells us that at this time Jesus had gone north. Part of the reason was clearly to have a break, to have a rest with the disciples. And they went into a house, and it says in Mark's Gospel, and he couldn't be hid. They were obviously trying to have a quieter time. And he couldn't be hid, and it says in Mark's Gospel, the reason they couldn't be hid is because of this woman. This woman found out where he was. He was inside the house, supposed to be low profile, or whatever we call it these days, but this woman discovered where he was. And she comes to the house, and obviously from the outside, to begin with, she is calling, Have mercy upon me, Lord, you who are the Son of David. These are Jewish titles. She had no right to anything that was coming from a son of David. Can you follow my reasoning in that? The Son of David was a title that was given to the one who was coming to fulfill covenant promises for the people of Israel. There was nothing in the covenant promises for the people of Israel that this woman had any right to at all. And yet she comes and she calls, Son of David, have mercy upon me. And this is interesting, this verse 23. I just wonder what this means, especially because verse 24 starts with the word but. Verse 23, But he answered her not a word, and his disciples came and besought him, saying, Send her away, for she cries after us. But he answered and said, But he would not do what they suggested he do. They said, Send her away. Just, she's crying after us. She's making a nuisance of herself. They knew, because this wasn't the first time he'd said it, that he had come primarily for the lost sheep of the house of Israel. This woman has no rights, no claims on any of the promises that you are now fulfilling to us. Send her away. She's making a nuisance of herself. He doesn't send her away. He reminds them and her of why he's come. I am not sent but to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And then it says this, then she came and worshipped him. And then she prays the most powerful prayer that is possible for anybody to pray. It's not eloquent. You don't need a great deal of intelligence or Bible knowledge to pray it. But it will always reach him. Lord, help me. She got no arguments. She got no arguments. She could have said, I suppose, don't we have some rights after all? You dispossessed us and our people. Don't we have some rights of whatever good is going to the land at this time? But there's nothing of that in this woman. There is nothing arrogant in this woman. There's nothing of pride in this woman. You can tell because the next thing that Jesus goes on to say is, he says, it's not right to take the children's food and to give it to the dogs. Now, she could have been highly offended at that. She could have said, well, if this is the way he's going to talk to me, I'm not going to stand around to be treated like this. Who does he think he is? But there was no pride in this woman. There was nothing in her that rose up and demanded rights. But there was something in this woman which was desperate just to get through to him. I'm a dog lover, but the Jews were not dog lovers. Dogs are never used in a kind sense in the Bible. They're always, well, if you saw how dogs lived in kind of hot lands, as some of you will have done, you'll know they're a nuisance. They're dangerous because they're probably carrying diseases, rabies and the rest of it. They are always digging around in the rubbish dumps. They are filthy creatures. They are covered in sores and fleas and flies, and they just are not pleasant. You must not think of your little, your golden set of puppy when you come across this verse, or whatever kind of puppy you've got. You mustn't. You mustn't. You must think of these almost skeletal things that you have hanging around the city dumps that nobody wants anywhere, but, well, if something falls off the table, maybe they can have that. That's all there is to it. The Jews regarded the Gentiles as dogs. The Jews regarded those who were uncircumcised as dogs. There's lots of places you could kind of see that. I'm tempted to go on and say something that Paul says, but I won't. I'll leave it. You know that Paul says beware of dogs in Philippians 2, I think it is, in verse 2. Dogs were not loved creatures. They were rejected creatures, not wanted at all. But there's nothing that's arrogant or proud that rises up in this woman. And I know what's happening because of what goes on afterwards, and we'll look at it in a minute. What's happening here is the Lord is provoking a situation so that what is inside this woman will come to the surface. There is faith in this woman. There is faith in this woman, the kind of which, the like of which, he has not seen in Israel. Only twice in the whole of his ministry did Jesus speak of great faith. Once was of a Gentile centurion, when he said, I've not seen faith like this in Israel. And this is the other time when he says to this woman, great is your faith. He was never able to say to a single Israelite, you have great faith. He never said it to a single one. But to one Gentile he referred to him in that way. And to this woman he said it to her. This is great faith. It was in her. He knew it was in her. And he allowed the apparent adversity and the hardness of this circumstances to provoke what was in her, to bring it to the surface. I was just talking to Paul as we sat together. We have something in common. Well, lots of things in common, I'm sure. But my hometown is Stoke-on-Trent, which is the Potteries. And at one time in my life, I worked at Wedgwood's, just as a labourer. But I worked with a man who was, you'll understand this, he was the last china thrower in England. That didn't mean he threw cups and saucers about. It meant that he worked on a wheel like Paul works on a wheel, but he didn't work with earthenware clay in the way that Paul works. He works with china clay. Now, china clay has a much weaker body. It's much more difficult to work with. And he was the very last one. And I worked with him, not doing anything skillful at all, but just humping and carrying heavy lumps of clay about and taking the stuff away when he'd finished it. And I remember vividly, in fact it just comes to mind now, that on the day I was leaving, he said to me, did I want to go? Well, I'd been itching to have a go all the time I was there. And usually the pattern of our day was that he would work all day, and it would take him and the woman who worked with him and me about 5 minutes to clear up. Well, I worked for 5 minutes and it took us the rest of the day to clear up. Because there's this thing called centrifugal force, you know, which is determined to spread this lump of clay as far as it can all over the place. I'll tell you what I was just mentioning to Paul. There's a verse in Jeremiah 18, I think it is, where God says to him, go down to the house of the potter. And as I was in the house of the potter, I watched lots of things. And one of the things that fascinated me was what the potter does first of all when he starts to work with his clay on the potter's wheel. And he takes the lump of the clay, and the first thing he does is he throws it. Maybe, I don't know where that's where the term thrower comes from, but he throws it, and then the next thing he does is he leans on it. We live in a part of this century where people are forever trying to eliminate pressures. You can't have beautiful cups and saucers without pressures. You can't have capacity without pressures. You see, that lump of clay has no capacity. It can't contain anything. It can't hold anything at all until it is subjected to a series of pressures, very carefully controlled by the person who is doing it. He controls the spinning of the wheel, and he works over the spinning of the wheel at a speed which is matched to the spinning of the wheel. Otherwise, in China, you get what they call a thrower's twist, which sounds like a terrible disease, but it's not that. It's just that you actually get the piece of clay. You can't see it, but on the inside of the clay, it hasn't grown up straight. There's a twist in it. And when it goes into the kiln and they fire it, it will crack. And it'll crack in this potter's twist because he's worked at the wrong speed measured to the spinning of his wheel. God uses pressures. He uses inward pressures and outward pressures. That we ought to have kind of Paul doing this, and I could kind of talk while he was doing it. You've got to have two pressures, you see, to give capacity. Once you've centered it, and God can't do much with it at all until he's centered us. He's got to get us dead center of his will. He's got to get us rooted and grounded, fixed, down, solid, down. Then he can begin to do something with it. He'll begin to apply pressures on the inside and on the outside. He will measure the pressures very carefully so that from the inside he pushes out, and at the same time he's pushing in from the outside. But he isn't pushing in from the outside with the same pressure that is pushing out from the inside. Are you following this? Because he's got to move it out slightly to give it capacity. It's all wonderfully controlled. He makes all things work together for good. He, a craftsman, is totally in control of that piece of clay. Totally. He knows what's in it. He knows what capacities it has. He will subject it to pressures which will give it its greatest capacity. And Jesus knew this woman. He knew this woman. He knew the pressures that were at work in her life. he adds some more pressures. It doesn't look as though he cares at all about what she's doing. It doesn't seem as though he cares at all. And she says, "True, Lord, yet the dogs eat of the crumbs which fall from their master's table." Then Jesus answered and said to her, "O woman, great is thy faith, be it unto thee even as thou wilt." And her daughter was made whole from that very hour. You know, we wouldn't be talking about this tonight if she had just simply said, "Lord, heal my daughter," and he'd done it. There would be no record of it. There were lots and lots of people he did that for. There were lots and lots of people that had demons expelled from them, lots and lots of people who healed. We have no particular record of them. We have a record of this woman because in this woman's life, he was able to do something because he knew what was in her. He always knows what's in us. He always does. There are times when it may seem as though he is harsh or uncaring, but he is always doing it in control of the pressures to produce things in us which could not be produced in us unless those particular pressures were allowed. But just so that you and I know that there's nothing mean in him at all, the story goes on then, I'll miss a few verses, into verse 32. And in verse 32, he's coming down the right-hand side of Galilee now. And there's a miracle that takes place here of the feeding, not of the 5,000, that had happened earlier. When they fed the 5,000, they were Jews. They fed them with 5 loaves and 2 small fish. And when their meal was over, they took up 12 basketfuls of fragments. You know that the number 12 is very significant to the Jewish people. There are 12 nations and there were 12 pieces of bread in the temple, and there were 12 stones that they took out of the River Jordan. It's a very significant number. It's almost a Jewish number, is the number 12. When they fed the 5,000, they took up 12 basketfuls of food. And the word that's used for basket really means a small basket. Because of the Jews' food laws, if they were traveling, it was impossible for them to get food that was clean for them, so they would carry it with them. And they would carry it with them in what was basically a kind of a lunchbox, a wicker lunchbox. It would just be enough food in this, basically, for one person. Some people think that the 12 baskets that were taken up afterwards were actually for the 12 disciples, because they had been so busy caring for everybody else that they hadn't had time for their own. It's possible. The word that's used when he fed the 5,000 is these 12 lunch baskets full of food that was left over. That was for the Jews. Now he's come to an area which is predominantly Gentile, which as far as the Jews were concerned, was beyond the pale. They were without hope. They actually said that about Jesus. They said, "Can any good thing come out of Galilee? Galilee, the Gentiles. How could anything of any worth come from that kind of area?" Well, he goes to this area specifically. He goes through these 10 cities of the Decapolis, and you have this gathering of people who almost certainly were predominantly Gentile. I'll read. Then Jesus, verse 32, "Then Jesus called his disciples to him and said, 'I have compassion on the multitude, because they continue with me now 3 days and have nothing to eat. And I will not send them away fasting, lest they faint in the way.' And his disciples say unto him, 'Whence should we have so much bread in the wilderness as to fill so great a multitude?' And Jesus saith unto them, 'How many loaves have you?' And they said, 7, and a few little fish. And he commanded the multitude to sit down on the ground. And he took the 7 loaves and the fishes, and gave thanks, and broke them, and gave to his disciples, and the disciples to the multitude. And they did all eat, and were filled. The Bible is a very, very simple book. If you want to be filled, you just have to eat. It really isn't very complicated at all. If you want to be filled, you just have to eat. That's all there is to it. They all did eat and were filled. And they took up of the broken meat that was left 7 baskets full. If any of you are using another version, maybe like the New King James Version, it will actually say something like 7 large baskets full. Because this is an entirely different word to the word that was used in the feeding of the 5,000. In the feeding of the 5,000, they took up 12 lunch baskets full of the fragments that were left over. When they fed the 4,000, who were predominantly Gentiles, they had over 7 baskets. It's exactly the same word which is used of the basket they put Paul in when they lowered him over the wall at Damascus. This is not a lunch basket. This is a man-sized, this is an enormous basket. This isn't just one meal for one person. This will keep the family going for the best part of the month. This is an enormous basket. This is the point I feel I want to stress tonight, and I feel it from my heart, maybe for some in particular. Maybe you look at the pressures in your life, and you say, well, why doesn't God change these things? Why does he make it apparently difficult so that I have to keep on asking? All right, I'm willing. There's no pride in me. There's no arrogance. I'll be content with just crumbs. Well, this is what I want to say. You have to be content with crumbs. You have to have the attitude of heart which would be content with crumbs. But he has no intention of giving you crumbs. He's going to give you baskets full. Enormous basketfuls. His heart is always to give you baskets full of his provision. But in you, there has to be the kind of faith that will hang on to him, even if it's only for crumbs. Do you follow that? There has to be the kind of faith which has no arrogance, no pride, no huffiness in it. No, oh, well, I asked him for that and he still hasn't done it. None of that. There has to be this thing that was in this woman. She was not going to go away. She was not going to go. She knew he was her only hope. And we'll put it like this. He could be as rude as he wanted to. He wasn't. But he could have been as rude as he wanted to. And she had no alternative. When Jesus was speaking on the mountain, in this passage that we call the Beatitudes, the very first thing he said is, blessed are the poor in spirit. There are different words for poor as well in the Bible. One word means someone who is so poor that he has to work for a living, you know, like you and me, or like you anyway. Someone who is so poor that they have to work in order to get enough money, in order to buy enough food, in order to gain enough strength, in order to go to work the next day, to earn enough money, to get enough food, and so on. Someone who is a poor man in that sense. But there's another Bible word for poor, which really means a beggar. Someone who is destitute. Someone who has absolutely no alternatives. He has no contingencies. If you spit in his bowl, he can't take offense. He's got nowhere else to go. That was the kind of poverty that this woman had. She had a poverty. She had a need that he would answer in her life, and she had nowhere else to go. This is faith. This is real faith. One of the problems, I think, with our faith at times is that it's not the genuine article. It's mixed faith. It's faith that's part in him and part in our own skill and ingenuity to get out of it if it doesn't work. We've always got some contingency plans. I'll trust him, but if it doesn't work, I've got this other thought here. That's not faith. Faith is total reliance with no contingency plans. It is absolute dependence upon him. The Bible calls Abraham the father of those who believe. It's because Abraham, there was a time in his life when he put all his faith in God. And you and I have to become children of Abraham. He is the father of all believers. You and I have to have the same kind of faith. Paget Wilkes, who was a missionary to Japan, who used to take the word faith with the letters and say it means forsaking all, I trust him. He said that's what faith is. Forsaking all, I trust him. And then he used to say this. He used to say, and I'm quoting, he used to say, it takes some Christians a lifetime to discover how all-inclusive that word all really is. It takes some Christians a whole lifetime because they don't forsake all. They forsake the bad things. They know they've got to turn away from their sins. But like Saul, you know, they save the good stuff for God. Even though God has said, I can't use it and it's got to go, they still say, well, there are some virtues here and there are some qualities here. There are some abilities there. We'll give these to God. He can't use them. And while you think he can use them, it's not faith. Not faith. You're really hedging your bets, if you don't mind me using that kind of phraseology. That's what you're really doing. You're basically saying, well, yes, I'll try a little bit of this. But if it doesn't work, well, that's okay. Nothing ventured. Nothing gained. And really, it's okay, because if it doesn't work, I've got some other plans anyway. It doesn't work like that. Faith is absolute dependence. God had said to Abraham that Abraham would be the father of a multitude. He was an old man. And Abraham believed in the Lord, it said. That's why Abraham is called the father of those who believe. The very first time in the Bible that the word believe is used, Genesis 15 and verse 6. If you were trying to find out what the Bible teaches about faith, and you started from Genesis, and you worked your way through saying, now what does it tell me about faith? You wouldn't know much at all until you actually got to Genesis 15 and verse 6. That's the first time the word is used. And it's of Abraham. I don't know much Hebrew, but the word for faith is an interesting one. It's amen. It's amen. You could translate it, Abraham amened the Lord. That's what you could translate it as. God said something to him, and with all his faith, all his confidence, with no contingency plans, Abraham said, amen. And it really means resting all your weight on a thing. This is what her woman had done. She had all her eggs in one basket. She was not going anywhere else. He might be the Jews' Messiah. Didn't make any difference. She was coming to him. He might say things which made her sound like a dog. And she might have to say, well, I'm just content to have one or two crumbs that fall from our master's table, if the Jews are our masters. It's okay. You can't insult me, because there's something in me that has got to have something that you have. That's faith. We've got to come like that, away with the arrogance and the pride that says, oh well, if he's not going to do it my way, I'm not going to have it. We have to come with this simple but desperate single-mindedness, single-eye faith, which simply says, Lord, I've got nowhere else to go. And I'm coming to you, and I'm going to keep coming. And if it's only a crumb you're offering me, well, that's okay. I'm going to keep coming, and I'm going to keep coming. But I want to say to you, well, he won't give you a crumb. He'll give you basketful. He's wanting to show two things in this. He's wanting to show the urgency, the desperation that needs to be in the heart of the individual. Is also wanting to show the fullness, the largeness that is in his heart. And he puts these two stories side by side so you can see there's nothing mean in God. There's nothing mean in him at all. But he will take risks with you. He'll risk you misunderstanding him. He'll do things and he'll bring things into your life that will risk you misunderstanding him, because he knows what's in you. And he knows that only by using those pressures, not eliminating them, but by using those pressures, it can actually bring capacity into your life into which God can put something that there would be no room for if you haven't had the pressures. Do you remember the story of the rich young man that came? He had everything. That was his problem. No space. No capacity in his life for God to do anything. No opportunity. He got nothing. And it's almost as though the Lord Jesus says to him, what you really need is need. That's what you really need. What you really need is need. So sell everything you've got, give it to the poor, come and follow me, take up your cross. That would have produced some pressures, wouldn't it? I don't know what happened to that young man. Oh, I know what happened in the short term. I don't know what happened in the long term. He has to make room for himself. I may have mentioned this to you before, but I recall some years ago, I was praying just on my own for different people that I knew. And it just seemed one of those times when I was so aware of all the different needs that these people had, and I was praying for this one and then on to the next one, then to the next one. And I was just saying things, I can't remember what I was saying, but I know how the Lord interrupted me as I was praying. And I was praying and I was saying, Lord, this person has this need, and Lord, this person has this need, and this person has this need. And it was one of those times when, as you're praying, you know that God is interrupting you. He is wanting to say something to you, even though you think you need to get to the end of this prayer list or something. He interrupts it. And he interrupted me in my heart, and I was saying, Lord, this person has this need, and this somebody has this need, and this person has this need. And he said, as clear as anything in my heart, he said, that's what you call them. And I kind of stopped in the middle of this prayer. And I said, well, what do you call them? And he said, these are my opportunities to be a father to them. These are his opportunities to be a father. It isn't that he is callous. It isn't that he doesn't care. He cares passionately. But this life is not the be-all and end-all. This is only part of it. This is only preparation. There are things that can be worked in you which will last forever. Now abide three things. Faith is the first one of them. Hope, love. I know love is the greatest, but faith is the first one. Faith is an abiding thing. This woman's faith is still abiding, is still lasting. We're still talking about it. He will do things in us, if we all trust him, which will last forever. Things that will bring glory to him through endless ages. Like this is bringing glory to him now. Still is. Because he was able to trust what was in this woman. There was faith in this woman. He was able to trust it. He was able to put apparent obstacles in its way. But it was all right. He knew what was in her. He always knows what's in us. He knows what's in man. He doesn't deal with two people the same. He won't take you this way and then take somebody else in your footsteps. He won't. Because everyone's capacity is different. But he will engineer circumstances and situations in such a way he will manipulate pressures and use them. He'll keep you under his hand. You needn't worry. You're under his hand. I've watched not a china thrower now, but an earthenware thrower. Their control over that, well, this is what Paul and I were just saying, their control over that clay when they're expert is really quite amazing. I have seen a man at Wedgwood's working on a thing called an egg bowl. Now, an egg bowl, when it's been fired, is this big. And shrinkage is about a third, isn't it? So it kind of starts off this big. And it's about this thick, and it's just a big bowl. And I have seen an earthenware thrower working with one of those on a wheel. And it was so accurate that when you looked at it from the top, you couldn't see it moving. That's the control that these experts have over this medium. It's the control that God has over you as well when you yield to Him. Utter, absolute control. There are no second causes for the Christian. It's all in His hands. It's all part of what He is doing to bring out of you that will glorify Him. But as He's doing it, don't ever mistake His character. There's nothing mean in His character at all. It's always enormous basketfuls, but He goes through these circumstances in order to perfect what He's doing in you and me. So trust Him, that's all. Just trust Him. I don't know what you're going through. I have no idea. You don't know what I'm going through. I'd be surprised if we aren't going through something. We usually are. That's what we're here for. That's why we haven't gone home yet. There's still things to do. He's still working. He's still ordering the circumstances, working all things together for good to them that love God. But please, please, I know you won't, but don't ever mistake His motive. His heart is always basketful. But His means is often this narrow way that isn't easy, but He knows what He's doing. He's trusting you, so you trust Him.